I think we have pretty much everyone, so welcome along, folks. I'm Greg, for those that don't know me. If you don't know me, afterwards, I'll be in next door, so somewhere around the couches. Come and say hi. Thank you for coming to this session. I know there are a number of data sessions on right now, so I'm really pleased you came along to this one. Thank you. And so, look, I'm a long-term data platform MVP and work with the product a long time. I think there are various versions of the product that have had a really good story, some a little less so along the way, but 2016 is one of the ones that has a really good feel behind it. And I saw a lot of clients who had perhaps taken up 2012. Not as many had done the upgrade work to 2014 because I think many didn't find that as compelling a story for them at the time. But 2016 has a real lot of things in there that are just worth the effort to get involved. And all I want to do in this session is sort of pick the highlights out of some of the ones I think are really important. And so I want to spend a while talking about T-SQL, which I know people don't normally do much anymore, but there's a lot of work went into T-SQL in this version of the product. But in addition to that, I'll spend a while having a look at temporal tables and a number of other things that we implement using T-SQL. Then want to spend a while having a look at application security because there are a number of things appeared in here as security as part of this version. And finally, 2016 is a game changer for developers, but in particular, Service Pack 1 is a game changer, right? And so we'll have a look at specifically why. So look, first up, what I'm not talking about in any detail here today are reporting services, analysis service and integration services, just to level set before we start. If you haven't, I will mention them really briefly though, and if you haven't had a look at reporting services, for example, in 2016, it got a real facelift here, is a big deal. Plus it got a lot of new capabilities that we didn't have before. And as long as I've used reporting services, one of the things people have asked is, how do I make it look like my corporate website? And because maybe they thought it was a little ordinary, the previous appearance of the portal. And so one of the nice things with this is it's now got the ability to have branding packages, so we can get in there and sort of build basically JSON, a little bit of JSON, and build a package out that says, look, this is how I want to brand the portal. The out-of-the-box one is already a lot better, but you can do an enormous amount of work in terms of branding. The other thing that's maybe a little less obvious, there's also a mobile report publisher. I'll just start him up. And the aim here, of course, is to build things that are targeted around phones and tablets and so on. So, for example, it's a click-and-drag thing. So I could say, look, I'd like to lay this out, pop him in this sort of size, maybe stick one of these up here, you know, lay him out. Yeah. Might as well have an opposing arrow and so on. And the idea is I can sort of lay out the sort of dashboard that I want to have appear. And this is on the master one, but I've got sort of tablet and phone layouts and so on. Now, those sort of reports, we can configure where the data comes from, and we can pick those up and drop those into that same reporting portal. The other thing, just to quickly be aware of there as well, is that when you go new here, you also have KPIs, and so you're able to go off and build KPIs that source data from elsewhere in the system and just build those straight out here in reporting services. So if you had looked at reporting services some time ago, a lot of people looked and said, hey, not much has happened since 2008 R2, and they'd be right. but 2016 is a version you need to have a really detailed look at what's appeared in terms of reporting services. Similarly for analysis services, we got a whole new compatibility level for tabular data models. There's a bit of work going on around multidimensional models as well. But there's a whole new way of provisioning and dealing with language and so on. There's a JSON-based syntax and so on now. There's another way of sort of provisioning and laying out the metadata and so on for those. I'd encourage you to have a look at that. All right, let's move on. And so in terms of T-SQL, the first up they've been dealing here with a number of things that people have been asking for a very, very long time. And so the... The first of these is string splitting. So most people in the room at some stage have had to build a string split of some type. Maybe we have a comma with a limited list and we want to pull the values out of that. It's one that they did a pretty good job on this. It's an intrinsic function, and so it's built in and it's quite fast. There are a couple of things we still think it's missing. Like, it doesn't give you the ability to trim the data in the list, and it doesn't have an option to have sort of like an index or a row number coming out beside it. But they seem to be things that they're actively looking at right now. But having the ability to do this very fast in code is really important. Another one is the ability to string escape. And so the idea here is that if I need to pick data up and put it in something like JSON or XML and so on, I need to do some processing on the string before I can sort of shove that inside that. And the only option that's there right now is for JSON, but you can see by the way they've built the syntax, clearly the thinking is well beyond that. Format came in 2012. We had the ability, it's basically the .NET formatting function, but what they added here is the format message. So this allows us to take messages, like from sys messages or the SQL Server messages, and generate out a formatted version of the data. I'll show you an example of that in a second. And you can do that rather than just doing it as part of raising an error or throwing an error. A lot of work in around binary data. Again, people have wanted the ability to compress and decompress data for a long time. And so it's basically like a gzip compression built directly in there now. And that works with quite large data types as well. One of the limitations of hash bytes in earlier versions was that it was limited to 8K of data at a time. And a lot of people wanted to use this. And I've seen people try and use checksum for the same purpose. What often happens is people have a row of data, lots and lots of columns, and they want to know, has that changed? And so then I have some incoming data. It's, do I compare it to every single column? Do I then worry about if it's nullable or not? How would I write the code to do that and so on? So it's kind of a case of building all that out and having to do those comparisons. And so what people will often do is they'll get all of the columns and wrap a checksum around it. Problem with checksum is it's only an integer, right? And so what it's going to do, I mean, you'll have occasional collisions possible on that. And you don't want to miss changes that have occurred. And so hash bytes has really been the right answer for that. It gives you a cryptographic hash. The problem was you couldn't have more than 8K of data. And so now it's got the ability to do that, and that makes a really big deal for us. They added some interesting new syntax. So die, affectionately called. So drop if exists. And when we first asked for this, we went, yeah, nice try, but what we really wanted was create or alter, right? And and Service Pack 1, we got create or alter. So the combination of the two is actually really quite excellent. I'm sure the number of people in the room who've over the years had to write code to upgrade a stored proc, for example, and say, you know, put it in if it's not already there, or maybe I've had to drop it and and replace and so on. There was no good answer for that previously, simply because if you dropped it every time and then re-added it, of course you lost all the permissions that were associated with it. And so that wasn't where we wanted to be. So we have been for a very long time asking about create or alter. But we got die in 2016 out of the box, so drop if exists. And that turns out to be very, very useful in a lot of scenarios. So, for example, one of the things I often build table types, and the problem is if I've used them as a parameter to a proc or something like that, the problem is then I can't sort of just drop the table type to go off and fix it. So now I can sort of script things where I can say drop the proc if exists before the definition of the table type, any of the ones that I use, and now say, you know, if the table type is there, drop it and recreate it and so on. But then I've got the ability to just say, look, if there is that proc, just go and move it on. That allows me to write much, much cleaner script than what I could do before. But create or alter, that was worth the price of admission on its own, that one. And another is session context. And so people have wanted some way that when someone connects to the engine, They want to have permission-based views. And so what session context? We did have context info before, and that was just like a little lump of unformatted data. What session context gives you is basically a property bag. So you get to go this property, this value, and so on, and there's a bag of those associated with the connection. And a really nice aspect of that is you can make them read-only as well. So the idea is that you could create a connection, you could populate it with the things that are required, make them read-only, and then pass the connection on to someone to use, and know they can't then go and change the values that are in that property bag. Okay? So that's lovely. And time zone and truncate table now supports partitions. I'll just show you a few of these. Okay, that's interesting. All right, so start up here. I've got, first up, there's the Wide World Importers database. And these are the new samples that we produced. In fact, I got to be the primary author of those, so I'm a little happy with them, indeed. And they're up at GitHub. All the code is published for those. And the aim of this is a little bit different to what we had with AdventureWorks. And so with AdventureWorks, the aim was to show every aspect of the product. Okay. Now, how many people have ever built a database that uses every part of the product? And my guess is no one, right? And so AdventureWorks actually happened to be the least typical database in existence, simply because of that, right? And a lot of things were sort of forced into it somewhat. And so what we did with Wide World Importers, we decided to have something a little bit bigger, potentially, a little more complexity in some areas, but a little simpler to understand in other areas. And we also made it so that it has the ability to simulate data. And so what it can do is you can say, look, go off and start running a whole lot of work, like a real database, on the current dates. I can simulate data from the date it was shipped up to the current date. So that way I can sort of, and I can control the rate at which that occurs as well. So that way I can sort of build out a database of whatever size I want, and I can also have it bring up to current data. That's important in there as well. We also made it so that it could work on standard edition at the time, straight out of the box. And there are procs in there that do things like enable capabilities that would be enterprise edition and so on. So they're all in there, but they were separate. And we tried to keep to fairly typical use of the product. Rather than trying to use every single thing. What you will find when you bring these down, so a couple of databases. So the first is just Wide World Importers, and so this is the 2016 one. I did create a 2014 one, which if anybody does need that, I've passed it up to the guys. It hasn't gone on the GitHub site as yet. But if you do need a copy of that, I can point you at that. Obviously, it doesn't use 2016 features, but pretty much all the rest of the stuff is there. And we also built a DW, a data warehouse. And so this is laid out with typical sort of, look in here. These are usual sort of dimensions, facts, and some integration code and so on. The other thing about this is one of the things I like to do in a dimensional warehouse is I tend to have naming and so on, which is much more directly suitable for end-user use, you know, and for analytics and reporting over the top of that. And so we've followed that all the way through that. To help with that, we also built integration services package, which is there, which can be used to sort of bring across and do incremental loads and so on of the data from the transactional system across into the warehouse. So there are also Azure versions. We've got DAC backpacks and so on for deploying to Azure and so on. So I think you'll find, hopefully you'll find a lot of things in there that'll be of value when starting to work with it. And if you have feedback, please send it. And so it's all good. And so, okay, so with Wide World Importers, so first up here, I'm just saying, look, select Aster from string split and exactly as you'd expect. It's a list of values, in this case common delimited, with a delimiter at the end. And I could have a space or a pipe or any of these things, and it's just simply going to give me back a set of rows out of that. One that, as it's a little less obvious, is string escape. And so string escape, as I said, is to take things that would need to be quoted if they went into JSON or areas like this. And so in this case, I'm saying string escape this bunch of text with JSON formatting. Anyone recognize the text? Ah, see, Brisbane crowd. Carol Lloyd, Railroad Gin, thank you. Yeah, so she died the other day. I was a bit sad to hear that. She was a rock legend here in Brisbane and the Gold Coast for an extraordinary long period of time in the 70s. Anyway, so that code here. So what this will do is sort of just quote that out, and let's have a look. So in here, so notice it's just encoded the carriage return line feed and so on for you. So it's done that sort of work. And things like this little bit here, and the site I grabbed the words from, they knew there was a word in here, they just couldn't tell what it was, right, in the way she was singing it. But anyway, so the slashes here end up becoming double slashes and so on. So anyway, so it's an encoding of the text to achieve that. All right. Now, next one is sysmessages. So if I look at sysmessages, these are all the messages you would have ever seen come out of SQL Server. Some you hope never to see, I might add. And they're in there for, there's a particular message number, and then what you have is you have different languages. So in the case of 1033, so this is English language in this case, or US English very specifically, and I've gone looking for a particular message. And so in this case, I've got the file named blah, does not exist. But notice there are always tokens there that they then shove the values into before they work with it, and you end up seeing it. And so if I said, look, format message, it's taking that message from the message catalog, and I'm shoving in master MDF. So if I execute that, we just end up with, you know, the file name master.mdf does not exist. So the idea here, of course, is you can add your own messages into the system catalog, and this gives you a way of using a format statement to generate the statements as well. But you can do that with system ones. Now, one thing to be aware of is in the catalog, the entries have to be message numbers 13,000 and above, and they also have to be ordered based on US English, which is interesting. And so it might not be immediately obvious, but if I took that same message in Chinese, which I've translated there happily for you underneath, but basically it looks very, very similar. But this one only has a single parameter. But of course, you can imagine in different languages, when you translate something, the order of the words is often different. And so that's one of the things you have to think about, is that, you know, if I was using a format of a message, you know, do I have to know what the language is before I start working out where to put all the values? And so they made a decision that says it has to be based on US English. So even though you might be showing them in another language, the order that you put the parameters in has to be the US English order, right? So the one based on 1033. All right. And so next one. So I've got declare a value, varchar max, and I've just said no, 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 and yes. That's a Vicar of Dibley reference, sorry for those. And compressed value, just compress that value. And of course, if we look at the length and decompress and so on. Now, the only thing that might not be immediately obvious is that, so obviously, you know, reasonable compression going on with something like that. But if we select out the decompressed value, notice what I got back was this. And so what I get back is a var binary max data type, not the data type that I had before I did the compression, all right? And so that's why I've then, after that, gone in and said I need to cast that back to what it was in the first place before I can do that. All right. They also added time zone info. And so what this one does is they've built in a reference for all the time zones. And one of the things that's nice with this is, so we could, for example, say at the moment where is currently DST is not equal to zero or something, and have a look at all the places that currently have daylight saving happening, right, and so on. So, but this is maintained and grabbed out of the operating system where those tables are maintained, but it's just become a view living inside SQL Server. What you can do with that, though, is you can process it. So in this case, I've said, look, select order ID from sales order, and picking completed when was a date time 2 value that said when. But then I said, look, picking completed when at time zone, East Australia Standard Time. Get the idea? And so that way I can say, yeah, that's when it did happen, but show me what that looks like at the moment, you know, as a as an Eastern Australian time zone. And so that allows you to see that in a variety of time zones if you need to inside the application. All right. Now, next one I want to mention are temporal tables. And so I was really, really excited when these appeared because they've been around the industry a long time. And I've seen people have quite some interesting attempts at trying to achieve this. What you're trying to do is have a table where you can get a view of what it did look like at a particular point in time. Right? So we often do this in data warehouses where you might have something like a slowly changing dimension. And so the idea is I have maybe a customer, but I have what it, you know, something about the customer changed. I know what it used to look like and so on. And part of the reason we do this is imagine if I have customers, say, in a sales territory, and then I rearrange all the sales territories. The question is, what happens when I look at last year's report? Right? You know, do they all magically have jumped to the new sales territories and so on? Now, that may be what you want, but it often isn't what you want. And so we typically do that in data warehouses. And so when I first saw this, I thought this is exactly what I would use this for. However, what they've done is there are three types of temporal tables in the industry. They have SIS temporal, which is based on the system time, which is what they've implemented. There's app temporal, which is based on the application time of some type, and bitemporal, which does both. And so they've done so far the first. I know they're working hard on the others, but what that means is that you get the change at the time the change occurs at the table, right? Now, in my case, when I was building the wide world importers things, I couldn't use that for type 2 slowly changing dimensions because the change occurs in the source system and sometime later ends up over in the other system. And so what I want is the time it occurred in the source, not the time it ended up at the destination, right? And so what I ended up doing instead is putting the temporal tables in the source system. That way all the changes are there, and then I could just peel the changes off across into the data warehouse. But it meant that the versioning was then present in the source system rather than just in the data warehouse. So this is based on that. You could use it for auditing. There's a lot of things where it makes for simpler development. And it's also possible to have these in memory as well. And so what you have is you have a table, but then you have an archive table associated with the table. And that archive table can be on disk if the temporal one's in memory. It can even be a stretch table with stretch DB. So you could have it stretched out into a file sitting up in a storage account, right, using stretch DB. A bunch of options for that. I'll show you this. All right. So first up, I've got an application people table. And if you look at the structure of this, the way it's shown in here looks different to other tables. So notice here there's an icon now with here's a table with a little clock sitting on it. So this is the thing telling you it's a temporal table. When you open that up, what you find is another table shoved inside it, which is the archive table. And so the columns are the normal system columns and so on. That's fine. But if you open up the archive table, again, you'll find those same columns and so on. And so what they've done key-wise, if we look at the keys here, they've actually sort of built a key. Let's have a look at the properties of that. And this one here, we've got one based on valid to and valid from. So this is the period for which that row is valid, the one that's in there. Now, for the
Anyone who's ever built tables that do this sort of thing, there's an endless discussion about what should be in the two. Right? Some systems you'll find people leave that null. You know, other people, my take on that nowadays, I actually prefer it to be a max date type value, simply because it avoids really messy logic inside your application where you're having to say if that's null or it's between this, you know, and so on. It ends up kind of nasty. The choice they made is they decided to have it based on like a max date value. So it does have that. And so if we look at, in this case, waiting for that to, there we go. So if I look at application people where person ID is 14, so this is Lily code, and what that's doing is showing me the current version of the row. And if I queried the people archive table instead, what this will do is show me all the previous versions of the rows associated with that row. And what you'll find is a set of non-overlapping valid to valid from type values sitting out there. Now, the way you get to use that is I can say select from application people for system time as of this. And so that'll then go back and show me for all of the customers in this case what that table looked like at that time. Make sense? And it's sort of finding the appropriate rows. Now, as well as saying for system time as of, you can say from to. So what that would do is return you the rows in the table that match the criteria, but then return you all the versions that occurred between that range of dates. Right? Or I can say between this and end, or I can say we're contained in, and then I can pass a list of dates and times in there as well. So I can do that. And finally, I could say all. So for example, I could say select Aster from application people for system time all, where it's 14, and order by valid from descending. And that'll give me sort of all the versions of the row for that particular value. Okay, not too bad. And so this is actually pretty neat. Now, one of the things that does come up, then people say, well, hang on, what if I want to change history? And we're being dictators try and do that. And so if I want to go back and say, look, history now looks different to what I intended it to be, it is possible to do it, right? If you try and go out and modify the table directly, the archive table, it won't let you do it. But what you do need to do instead is to go and turn it stop it being a temporal table. Then you can go and modify it. Now, to give you an example of how to do that, I've put procedures in here. Deactivate temporal tables before data load and so on. And so these procs, I had to use it because when I'm loading up past data, of course, I had to be able to do that, exactly that. And so if I say, look, deactivate temporal tables before data load, and I look at the proc for this, the main thing it's doing is it's saying alter the table, set system versioning off, and then alter the table, drop period for system time is the main wording that occurs here. Then I go off and do whatever it is I have to do on that table. And then I've also, I've got a reactivate in here that'll give you an example of how to do it. And so if I look at reactivate, what I've done in here then is alter table, add period for system time, and you specify the columns that are related to that. You say set system versioning on and the history table is there. So one of the questions comes up is, can I name the history table anything I like? Yes, you can. You don't have to create it as a temporal table in the first place. You could just create a table, create the history table, and then you could join it up, right? I mean, that's fine. But it has a standard that they use, but you put it as part of the definition of the table in the first place. And then the final one says data consistency check on. And this is going to go through and make sure that all of those things don't overlap, you know, and that every period makes sense. Now, that's what it's going to do. And this is a bit like where we have foreign keys. You know, you can have a trusted and untrusted foreign key. Same deal here. So if you re-enable this but don't do that, then it's going to limit the types of things that it could be used for from that point on. All right. So anyway, so there's example code in there for a lot of that stuff sitting inside the database. Now, next one I want to talk about is JSON integration, and this has been a high request. If you look at the Connect website, and in 2005 we got support for XML, and they did an amazing job of building that support for XML. But half the industry sort of moved to JSON the next year. And if you've looked at the Connect site, there's probably the number one or close to the number one requested thing has been some sort of JSON support built into the engine from that point on. And so this was a very, very high feature request. And so there are a number of things where you might want to do this. You might be generating content for websites, or you might have a flexible database schema. In fact, one of the challenges that I found myself sort of pushing back on when I was building the sample is that people who are mad keen on JSON would have been happy for the product or the stock item table to just be a key and a piece of JSON. You know, like, no. I actually wanted like real columns in there as well. Now, so it does raise the question of like what is it you're going to use this for in the database? Now, JSON has lots of uses outside the database, but if we look at the types of things we can do in here. So first up, like we have an XML auto, there's a JSON auto. So if I looked at these orders, I've got a set of orders. If I said, look, just go off and give me that with a JSON auto, and I end up with a lump of JSON. And so the first question everybody asks is, why is it one big long line, right? And so, sadly, I'm trying to get them to put something in there for that. So I always have a JSON pretty print open beside me all the time, but I'm hoping that will end up in the product somewhere. And what I can do is, pop this in and have a look, and you get the idea of the sort of structure that it's then gone off and generated for you. And so in this case, it's a JSON array, so we've got a sort of a piece of JSON, like a node element here, and then this opening one saying this is an array, and then a bunch of values down from there. Now, you can deal with fairly arbitrary shaped JSON, but clearly when you're working in a relational database, the more tabular the stuff is that you're working with, the easier it'll be to make sense of that along the way. So let's have a look here. And so if I then said JSON path is the first one, and so like we can say for XML path, where I can then specify the shape of the XML, it's the same thing here. So I can say order ID as order.id, order.date for order date, and I can say order.customer.purchaseorder, and I can put the path that will end up inside JSON inside that. So if I open him up, and let's go back to our friendly neighborhood pretty printer, and then you can see the structure of this. So I said order dot, and then I had ID, date, and customer, and then under customer, I then had purchase order and so on. So by simply just the names and the dots, you can sort of specify the shape of what you want that to look like coming out. Okay, so next is I might have an incoming value. And so if I have a little lump of JSON coming in, no surprise, there's an isJSON function that'll just tell me that is valid JSON. I've also got open JSON, like we have open XML, same sort of deal. And so if I just say, look, select aster from open JSON, then that'll sort of return me back an interesting set of data where it says this key in the array, because it was an array I sent in, has this value, which is the JSON element inside that. And then it literally has a type that says this is one of these types of elements. What I can do with that value, though, is I can then start applying things to this. And so first up, a with clause, like I can do with the XML option. So in here I could say, look, here's my incoming value, select aster from OpenJSON with order number, go and get that from the root element, dot order dot number, and then so on, the date and the different data types here. And so that'll just rack that straight back into a sort of a relational set of columns. Another type of thing I could do in here, let's have a look, is I can call JSON value. So that one says drill in and find a specific value. So in this case, I've said, look, here's a little lump of XML that I want to go from the root element to item to price. So root element, item, and then price, and get that value. And JSON value would return that. Again, it's going to return it as a SQL variant, essentially. And so what I would typically be doing then is casting that as something, like in this case, an integer. When you look at it, it'll look very much the same. In this case, I cast the quantity. That one there, I just grabbed the price. But the deal is anyway, so the first one would be a variant, the second one would have an actual typed value. I can also do JSON modify, somewhat like we had XML modification. So I can say, look, take this lump of JSON, find the quantity, and go and drill down to the quantity and replace that with 12. Right? So that sort of thing works as well. And so again, if I look at this, somewhere in here, I'll find that I've replaced that with a 12 inside the JSON. So now they didn't build a JSON data type, right? We don't have one of those. But they've done a pretty good job of everything else, right? And in fact, I'd say better than what we have in some other areas. Now, one of the things that's nice about not having a new data type is that we don't need new client libraries. We don't need connectivity options, all these sorts of things. They get to still work exactly the same. And so that way, it's just traveling around as though it's like an nvarchar or nvarchar max or something like that, a string type data type. Alrighty, now what I also use this for, if you look at the definition of application people, so I had an application people table in there, and if we script that out, down in here, so a couple of things while we're in here. So first up, notice this is the syntax for the columns for the temporal, I'm saying before. So it's generated always as row start and generated always as row end. These columns you can't go and set yourself. And it also says period for system time. As I said, keep in mind the ANSI syntax has application time and other options in there. And system versioning on. So, and this is the name of the archive table that it'll create. So they're all there. But the main one I want to show you right now is just this other languages. And so I had a custom fields. And what I've done with people and stock items and all of those is I threw a custom fields in there, which is kind of like the little grab bag of things that you might want where someone wants often custom columns in a database. And this allows me to just throw a few things in. So, for example, out of all the stock items, there's a whole lot of stock items in here, but there's a handful that are edible. And so some of them have a use-by date. Right? And things like that. But instead of just adding columns for every one of those things into the database, I'm able to just put a custom fields thing there and go, and here's the use-by date if it is that sort of product. And similarly for people, what I did is I had other languages they speak. And so I was then able to, in this case, create a calculated column saying as JSON query in the custom fields, go and find the other languages they speak. And so this would give me another column sitting in there for the application people, calculated based upon that JSON value. And so over here, and so I've got the other languages sort of extracted in here, which are somewhere in the middle of that custom fields thing that was sitting there. Another thing I've used this for, of course, are things that aren't processed in the database. So for example, here, I've got things like user interface themes and settings and these sorts of things that the relational database has no interest in at all, but this gives us a place that we could just throw a property bag of those sort of things associated with the user. Good-o. So JSON and SQL Server, so no special support. If you do, for the actual data type itself, if you do need something much, much more sophisticated with that, then DocumentDB is the answer for that at the moment, right? And so DocumentDB is more of an arbitrary JSON store. It has a whole lot of very, very nice characteristics to it as well. So for example, it does automated indexing. You sort of control the degree of indexing you want to occur and so on, but it's much better suited to sort of arbitrary, just straight out JSON store. However, SQL Server now is already part of that game, so it's not doing too badly. Next one I want to mention, in-memory. How many people in the room have started to work with in-memory tables? Yeah, a couple, right? Look, they'd really like to see that be most of the room, right? Somewhere along the way. Now, if I look at the reasons why that is, the main one has been that it was Enterprise Edition only for a lot of the clients I deal with. That's a challenge. And for a lot of people, they also haven't really got their head around yet how I might use it or might not use it. The thing to understand is when I talk to product group people, they think of the disk-based tables as legacy tables. And, you know, all the focus of so much stuff is on, you know, in-memory is probably where all these things are going to be. And if you look at most other database engines that have in-memory support, they have a separate product. Right? So they'll have you have an in-memory database or you have the normal disk-based database, normal in quotes. And so, but what's nice about the way SQL Server's done it is they give you the chance to move tables and so on as you see fit. The thing that is incredibly important, though, is that the real performance, there's a couple of areas where the real performance comes from. One is you can use it as a high-speed sort of like shock absorber for data that's arriving from somewhere. It can deal with that much faster than disk-based tables. The other thing that it's interesting to use it for is to replace temporary objects. So where you would have had temporary tables, table variables, things like that, I can build memory-optimized table variables even when I'm writing disk-based code. And instead of temporary tables, I could use permanent tables keyed off your session ID or something like that. But the difference is I can build tables that are durability schema only, so they have zero logging, don't go and hit temp DB, you know, all these things. This can make a very interesting replacement for that. You still have to think, I'm working through at the moment scenarios where it doesn't make sense for me. But those sort of things are important. The real power, though, comes once you get natively compiled code. And so I have, for example, stored procs that take, say, 26 seconds to run. I move the tables in memory, it takes 25 and a half. I move the code in memory, it takes 60 milliseconds. So it's chalk and cheese. I mean, there just is no comparison at all. The hassle, though, is getting the code in there. So in terms of the tables, when you right-click them, there's a memory optimization advisor. And in 2014, I wasn't a fan of this. It just used to tell me all the reasons why I couldn't do it, right? And 2016, it's now way, way better story in terms of the things that it supports. And that one actually has become quite useful. And it will also help you go off and build the required file groups and things like that as part of the deal. Similarly, when you right-click a stored proc, there's a native compilation advisor. That one's still not 100% my friend. so that one still has... It is hard for them. It still has a lot of limitations. And the reason is, you can imagine, they're having to kind of rewrite the whole language, you know, version by version, to push it across into in-memory stuff. The two things that have caused me the biggest difficulty with that at the moment have been the lack of case statements. And the lack of subquery support. And so subqueries, without that, I end up writing loops all the time, and that feels a bit 1970s-ish when I'm doing that. But they're fast, right? So it sort of feels unclean doing it, but they're really fast when they run. So yeah, maybe. But case statements are difficult. And so if you look at MSDN, they give you an example. They say, look, if you need a case statement and you've got two options, just write the query twice with different predicates. Clearly, that's not a plan, right? As I often have 8 case statements with a whole bunch of options, and I can't write the query 60 times, right? I mean, that wouldn't be manageable. So one of the things I'm most looking forward to in vNext, which is already in the second CTP, is it has case statement support and a number of things as part of this. So even if you find it a little hard right now, keep persisting, right? Down this track. 2016 gets you a lot further. And licensing gets you a long, long way with that now too. Another one is Polybase integration. And so this allows you to connect out to things like HD Insight and so on. But one of my favorite things with this is I can just connect to an Azure storage account. And so I might have a whole bunch of files, for example, like CSVs or something, sitting in a storage account. I can now point at that and then treat it like it's a table from inside SQL Server. They've also been doing work on R language integration, and this allows you to bring sort of predictive analytics and things directly into this part of the database. And this is interesting because a lot of this stuff, there's so many places I'm at that could make detailed use of this sort of thing, but it was always something somewhere else, you know, outside the database, a completely separate thing. Now it's embedded right in there. And if you look at how they did it, clearly they are allowing for all other languages to go in there as well. So they've done R, but you have this sort of SP execute external script thing. Clearly, you know, they must be thinking Python and other things, you know, as languages in there. I'm only guessing, but I mean, that's the other one that you usually see in the data science areas. For anyone who hasn't had a detailed look at this and is interested to try learning a bit of this, one of the other things they have at the moment is a Microsoft professional program for data science. I encourage you to go and have a look at that. Right? They've put it up as an EDX course, which is an interesting model. So it means you can attend any of the courses for free. In fact, if you want to go and learn astrophysics from, you know, the best people in the business, you know, there are courses up there to do that sort of thing. The idea that you can just go and learn all this stuff from the best people nowadays is breathtaking, right, and for free. But if you want to be certified, what they do then is they have a nominal fee of about $49 or something US for each of the subjects, if you then pass the exams and do things, and then they build them up into a program that you can then complete. Now, what they've done for data science, they've got a really interesting mixture of everything from an intro to data science. They've got a whole bunch of quite good Power BI course that's up in there. And then if you look at the others, they've got a stats subject taught by Columbia University. There's an R subject from a company that does R work. There's an advanced R subject from a university in Denmark, and so on and so on. So it's an interesting model where they get some of the best people on the different areas, bundle it all up into a single offering. Right? And so that's actually really quite interesting. But if you want to get your head around R, that's actually not a bad way to do it. And those subjects are available even if you're not doing part of that course. Right? So just go up and have a look at the stuff that's at EDX. All right, I'll just quickly show you this. With the Polybase connection. And so what I've got here, I'm sitting up in the cloud, I've got some files. Now, if I say create external data source as Azure storage, I'm saying type as Hadoop. It doesn't have to be Hadoop, though. This is just files sitting in Azure storage. And then we've said WASBS is the moniker for this. And then that's the name of the container. And that's the name of the set of data up there. So if I say create an external data source for that, and then I can say, look, the files that are sitting up there, I could define my own comma delimited file format and then say, it's delimited text, here's the separator, things like that. And then where they end up, each of the databases now has an external resources area. And so we end up with a data source in here and a file format here. And then what I do is I say, look, create me an external table with this name, then it just looks like a table. Here are the columns, and this is where you go off to go off and connect to that. So I can grab that. That'll go and make sure I can connect to it and so on. And then if I just query this, this takes it a moment, but I mean, this becomes just a table that I can use then inside SQL Server, where it's ripping the data out of those CSVs that are sitting up in the storage account. This is nice, right? I like being able to do this. Now, the other thing this is useful for, if you're in Azure SQL DB, you can also build external tables that refer to tables in other databases. And so I think in the end, this will probably replace linked servers and synonyms and all those sort of things, which if you've used are a bit painful because they don't do IntelliSense and they do all that, where external tables, IntelliSense works, you know, all those things work as expected. Sorry, there was a... Yes, you can actually connect to a storage account in Azure doing the same sort of thing. What you can't do today is you can't do that on-premises to connect to an Azure SQL DB. but one day soon, you know, I'm kind of hoping that'll appear. Yes? No, actually, you can define the file formats and things like that as well. So because the question was, does it have to be a CSV? And no, the answer's not. Yeah, it doesn't. Alrighty, so anyway, so that's there. Now, in terms of application security, tracking okay time-wise, what's appeared in security? So first up, they've moved a lot of the settings to database level. And so configuration, there are now database scoped configuration. Things like credentials and so on can now be done at the database level. And this is clearly so they can pick databases up and move them around, particularly in cloud arrangements. If you have in-memory OLTP, it now supports transparent database encryption. I normally always warn people about that one. If you haven't played with TDE, TDE is not something you play with, okay? And so that's a, what do they call it? A career-limiting move, if you get that wrong, a CLM. And so, look, TDE is a wonderful thing, and it's really, really easy if you do it in Azure and so on, which it is now as well. But I encourage you, just make sure you've been through the entire life cycle of using it before you then go off and try and deploy that on premises, right? And that involves restoring databases on other servers and things like that. You don't want any surprises down the track, that's all. But it's actually a very good technology, but it does what it says on the can, right? It it actually stops people getting to things that that they shouldn't. And so you don't want to be seen to be the person who shouldn't get to it. All right. And so, look, they also added some support for row-level security in this version of the product. And so the aim here is to have a centralized way of controlling who has access to the rows. Okay? And so you could do this before by building views, putting them over the top of things and so on, but they're not bound directly to the table where this is. And so this is quite transparent to the application. So I'll give you an example here. Let me open two of these. And so what I've done, I'm creating a user called Great Lakes User and a login, and I've done two of those and then used that database. And I'm then creating a user for that Great Lakes User in the database. I've created a user for the website. And then I've added a role, people who can get to Great Lakes stuff, I'm adding in the Great Lakes User. But what this then does, I can go off and apply the policy and say, look, configure, and I've put it all in the proc to make it easy for you to work out how it works. But what it's doing under the covers is it's creating a function that takes a city ID, returns a table, and so it doesn't have a lot of the performance problems you'd have with a scalar function or something, because it's a table-valued function. With schema binding, so I'm not going to let the table change while it's there. And then it says, look, select one as access result where the role is DB owner, or there's someone who's allowed to get to it. Or alternately, if it's the website under the covers who's logging on, or if the session context contains the appropriate value. So I've got a way I can sort of build a function out and go, these are the deals under which somebody can get to this. Now, a few questions I had straight up, people asked me, does that name have to be a specific name? The answer is no. Does this have to be a specific value? No. In fact, the mistake I made when I first tried this, I returned zero for the ones that couldn't. The way it works is if any data comes back, then you're allowed to use it. So that wasn't what I was expecting. Anyway, so then we say, look, create a security policy, add a filter predicate on that table, so adding that predicate, and then I've also added a block predicate. So what I'm saying here is, okay, so maybe you're only allowed to see Great Lakes rows, but the question is, what happens if you modify one and you try and turn a Great Lakes row into a Midwest row, right? Then I'm not going to let you do that, right? So that's what the block predicate is there for. And so if I look at the principles that are already there, I have both a user and a role. So I've got a role for Great Lakes, and I've got a user here for that. So if I select from customers, I've currently got 663 of them down here. But if I grant permission to that role and give it access, and then I impersonate that user, but notice then I simply run select from customers, and in this case now I only get 77 rows, right? And in fact, if I look at where they are, what we'll sort of see, go in and sort of look at these things. In fact, I'll join it to this here. I'll join it to a US border. Now, and you'll be able to see that they're sort of up around the Great Lakes is the people that we're looking at, right? So these are the customers they're now allowed to see. All right. And if I try and update the row to a different area, then the block predicate says not going to happen. Okay. And I'll revert back out. And I'll just drop these. Okay. I'll get this far. Okay. Next one I want to show you, though, is if I'm using the session context thing. And so what I do here is if I look at, let me grab, in fact, I want to log on as that website. Just change the connection. And I'm going to, do I have one there? No, I don't. I'll just call this website. Oh, no, sorry. That's the server. That'll do it to me. So what I'm going to do here is change the login to website. And this is SQL Rocks was the password for this. And so that'll get me connected, and I'm in Worldwide Importers. So if I now look at who I am, I've come in as website. If I look at the customers, then I actually get no access to it at all. But notice if I set my session context, which would be done by the application, not by me, I set that, and then I look at my session context. It says I'm in the Great Lakes lot, and then I select from that. Again, I'll be back to that same 77 rows, you know, the ones I see. So the idea is that the application can connect you, put that into the session context. You can't change it, and then from that point on, you're in business. And let me tidy that up. Okay, oh, it's currently logged on. That'll do it to you every time. Ah, fix it later. No problem. Alrighty, so a couple more items. So we also have dynamic data masking. And so dynamic data masking is saying, look, some people in the organization are not allowed to see all the data as it is. And so what we do with dynamic data masking is if you look at the purchasing suppliers table, sitting inside this, there are bank accounts and things like this that I might not want everybody in the organization to see. And so if I create a user here, that's not already there, I've got a non-admin user. I'll use that. And if I look for, and here I'm looking for masked columns. Sorry. So what I'm looking for here is I can run a query to say, look, show me the masked columns in the database. And so there's now an isMasked property for that one. And so the idea is I can create a user who's a non-admin type user, grant them select on the table, but then when they let's execute as that person, then when they select from suppliers, notice that over here, the columns have been sort of masked out. For that user. So the data type doesn't change or anything, still comes back as a string, just doesn't show you the value. And so for things like email addresses, I think it, from memory, it gives you the first letter of the first one, the @, and then like the first letter of the domain, you know, it fiddles around with it and does a fairly good job. And so that's what data masking is about. And the aim is, without you sort of changing anything terribly much in the application, it's just going to show you or not show you the values. Now, clearly, you know, you couldn't then update that value or something. I mean, that's a different story. Sorry? License separately. No. It's even in Express. How good is that? Okay. They also have always encrypted. And so what always encrypted is about is saying, what if I don't trust that pesky hosting provider, right? That I'm using. So maybe I've got data that, even though they're an admin type person, I don't want them seeing that data. So what I want is I want encrypted data up the other end, but I want the certificates to stay with me. But I want to do as little change to the application as I can get away with. So what they do is there's a support in a new ADO.NET 4.6.1 that has support now for always encrypted. And if you put an appropriate connection string entry, then whenever it goes out and makes a request, it goes and says, do I need to encrypt these parameters? And then it sends encrypted parameters down instead of real. Now, it still has some support for equality if you use a symmetric encryption, or like a reversible type one. and so on. So it has some equality and things like that. You can do group buys, and there's a few of those. But clearly, because it's an encrypted bit of data, that limits the types of things you could do at the other end. Let me show you this. So what I've done here, so I've said use this, and I've got some new table I want called supplier private details. See, no, drop table if exists, wonderful stuff. And then I've gone off and created some keys if I need them, and I'm making sure they're gone. All right, so the first thing I need to do is I need to create a certificate that I can use for doing this encryption. And so where this has been done, let's refresh this. Okay, under security, we now have always encrypted keys. And what I can do in here is create a column master key. And so I can say this is my WWI column master key. And then it's, in fact, I've got one sitting here. And then it says, look, where's that going to live, right? So it's got a thumbprint and stuff for it. Now, this is not, I'm creating it on the server. But usually this would be picked up, removed from the server, and then sent to the client, right? So it's only the client end that would have access to this. And so once I do that, I can say generate a certificate. It'll generate a certificate. I can say okay. And that becomes this. I can then create from that a column encryption key. So column encryption key, I'll call it, based on that column master key. And okay. And so this then allows me to start building a key I can use for encrypting columns. And so then they appear. If I look at sys column master keys, they're in there. And sys column encryption keys, they're in here. And the only thing that's then different is that when I create a table, notice what I do is I say, I say encrypted with this column encryption key, I can say deterministic. If I want something to be able to do equality and so on, those sort of settings, and then which algorithm I want to use. And so in this case, AES, I've given it a choice and said, hey, go off and pick one of these. Now, once I do that, what I have to do is then get that certificate, pull that out and install it into the client application, run a client application. But then the beautiful thing is, from the client's point of view, it just sends the tax file number or whatever. The ADO.NET layer traps that, works out that it needs to be encrypted, then encrypts it and sends the encrypted one, which is the thing that gets stored in the database. But unlike normal column encryption, where the data type of the column is var binary max, this is actually still knowing that this is an NVARCHAR30 and so on. So it knows that the underlying data type before the encryption has occurred is this one. Kind of neat. So, and that's what the always encrypted does. Now, the one downside of that is that whenever you have your setting, the column encryption enabled in the connection string, problem is what it's going to have to do with every call, it's got to make a round trip before it makes the call to say, you know, is this something that needs encrypted parameters? Right? So there's a query overhead or a round trip overhead whenever you do that. However, if you need it, you need it. So that was there. And so look, finally I want to talk about 2016 SP1. And so the first thing is the tools have now become quite separate. And so you'll notice that Management Studio and SQL Server Data Tools now ship completely separately to the product. They're trying very quickly to get into a sort of a monthly cadence as these things come out. And the team, Ken Heining and the guys that are doing Management Studio, they're just wonderful. And so if you've ever had things where you think, don't I go up and post things at Connect and nobody ever listens and whatever, I'm putting things up there now and 2 weeks later it's in the product. You know, it is a completely different thing to deal with. And the guys are really, really responsive. I'm quite impressed. The other thing they maintain is they maintain a Slack board where you can go up and sort of talk about and query different ideas and things that people are kicking around for the product. That's actually really, really good as well. And so that's actually become a really dynamic team. I'd encourage you to get on and try the things they're doing. The new version of Management Studio works from 2008 forward, So it becomes a single tool that you can work back against those versions. And now it's pretty much the only one I use now. Although they have a vNext preview out there already that has a few more things already in it. But for production work, the current 16.5.3 or something or 0.4 is the version of it. And they're removing the sort of versions from Management Studio. So we won't talk about 2016 Management Studio and so on anymore. It'll just be this particular build numbers going forward. Developer Edition. I was pretty proud of this one. And it's something that happened earlier last year. But I looked at the Visual Studio group, and they had Visual Studio, and they had the Community Edition, which made it really, really easy to get hold of Visual Studio and start working with it. And we kept having the Where is the SQL Server Community Edition discussion? Because I wanted to make it as easy to get started with SQL Server as anything else. I had friends here in Australia trying to buy it and couldn't work out how to buy it, the developer edition, even though it was like a next to no cost. That's all gone. So if you now, you have to join the Visual Studio Essentials program, I think it's called, Andrew? Yep. But once you've done that, there's a whole bunch of these tools and things you can download, including SQL Server Developer Edition, which is now free, and this is good. So a little bit of harassment ended up working well. The samples, as I said, now what we've done with those, the Worldwide World Importers ones, I can't tell you how many times I've said Worldwide Importers, but it was a name Microsoft could register. It was the other way around. And so what we've done is all of those are up at GitHub, and so all of the code is there for that. The other thing to be aware of is that I built the whole database metadata-driven, and so there's actually scripts up there that generate all the metadata that the database was built from, and then all the scripts are there that generate the database from the metadata, right? And so this is why I'm confident that things are cleanly named and, all the appropriate things are the same in all the places. It was all metadata-driven. But all of the code for doing that is up there as well. Right? As well as all these internal procs and things and stuff that you need. So I encourage you to get up and start playing around with that. Consistent programming surface. This is my favorite one that's happened lately. And so this was in Service Pack 1. I used to struggle quite a lot with different sites I'd go into. I work a lot with software houses. And invariably, they wouldn't use features that were only in Enterprise Edition. And so the downside of that is I had clients who were selling to clients of their end customers of all different sizes, and this ends up with gigantic clients then using standard edition features on gigantic databases and so on. This was not sensible, right? And if you look at features like in memory, that needs to be coded in by the developers up front. It's not something you can just retrofit at the back end. And so we've had a long, long discussion about this, and they just come full circle. It's just amazing. So 2016 Service Pack 1, if you look at the things that are in there now, that were all Enterprise Edition level features before, it's completely amazing. And so if you have discarded, everything from compression to partitions to all of these things, they're all there now, okay? And so this is just gold, that being there. So a couple of others I want you to consider. Updatable non-clustered column store indexes are an interesting one. I should have thrown the word filterable in there as well. Just have a long name. But in 2012, we got non-updatable, so non-clustered column store indexes. So you added a column store index to the table, but the table became read-only. So there were a lot of challenges with how to deal with that. 2014 gave us clustered column store indexes, but if you had non-clustered, they were still not updatable. So 2016 now has updatable non-clustered column stores. And the other thing they did, which I wasn't expecting, is they made them filterable. Now, why this is super important is that I can have an operational system that people need to do big aggregates and things over. I can now build a column store over the top of some of those tables in the transactional system so that I get the aggregate performance. And then I can just have aggregate queries running over that without having the impact on the rest of the table that's being used. Now, the other thing I can do is I can have it filtered, so I could also exclude the current rows if I really want. So I could say up to yesterday, for example, or something like that. And the final one is that I can also delay the time when it gets rolled up into the column store. So what's brilliant about this is it then performs like a normal index until it rolls up, and you can specify the period of time before that occurs. And so this is actually a world of goodness. You'll find that they call this operational analytics, but again, it's a game changer in there in terms of what we can do. StretchDB, not my favorite thing yet. Okay, so it's a good aim, and they're trying to allow you to stretch databases out into the cloud, but be able to have compute at the other end as well to help you. It's almost getting there, but it's still got, for me, a fair number of limitations. Some people that might suit. Query Store came in. This helps us deal with pesky query plans that get nasty. It's more of a DBA topic, but I just want to really quickly show you where that is. And finally, Live Query Stats, which is insanely cute. So, okay, so with each of the databases now, there's now a Query Store node sitting inside here. And what you can do with a Query Store is it tracks query plans over time. And so everybody has scenarios where they end up with some query plan that ends up performing badly at some point. They're all often wondering why. So if we look at the overall resource consumption, this will show us straight up without doing any other work, duration, execution count, logical reads, and so on. And if I drill into these, this will then show me the query, show me, notice big difference between those two sets of executions. It'll then show me the different query plans and how well they ran over a period of time. Typically shows us the code if it's still in memory, sitting down here. And then each of these query plans, it'll sort of show me how it was performing and so on. And if you've ever tried to do plan guides, which were awkward to set up in earlier versions, the aim now is I can sort of point at one of these when I'm happy with the plan and then just say forced plan, and it'll say keep doing this. Okay, and so this is a world of sweetness compared to what we used to have to do to get around this. And there are a lot of interesting graphs and things associated with that. Final one I want to show you, this, which is sort of almost beyond cute. But if you have long-running queries, where you're sitting wondering, like, when will this ever be complete? And so this look and go, okay, yeah, that didn't run for too long. But notice I can now, where is he? One of these, include live query stats. And if I turn this on, notice as it runs, it actually shows me where it's up to. Ooh. Yeah. And so, in case you didn't see that, but yeah, I'll just quickly do it again. But you notice the operators tell you what percentage they're up to in terms of feeding the data and so on. This is cool. So it's like, you can just sort of see it forming its way through. Now, there's an overhead in enabling that, but that's sweet. And it looks cute. It looks really cute. Alrighty. So to continue your learning path, so Channel 9, obviously there's a lot of material up there, including Andrew and the guys will be sticking lots of content up from here from the event. For example, I know you're missing Sunil's session and Rob's session and so on right at the moment, so they'll all be up there as well. I was kind of hoping. I hope you enjoyed Spark After Dark. So that's all good. And look, thanks for that, folks. And look, I'll be in the speaker's lounge after.